Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama took a break from his vacation today to say he thought Ben Bernanke should keep his job, praising the Republican Fed chair's bold and out-of-the-box thinking. Economists agree that the special lending programs that Bernanke created to pour money into the financial system are a radical departure for the federal bank, but critics say he gave too much to banks, and we're not out of the woods yet. Two reports today from the White House and the Congressional Budget Office pretty much say the federal deficit will explode in years to come. Bernanke is going to face a Senate hearing before being confirmed. So meanwhile, let's get a view of where we are in the economy. It's a decidedly liberal view from Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and columnist for The New York Times. He was a thorn in the side of the Bush administration and is proving to be quite a splinter for Obama as well. Newsweek magazine calls Krugman Obama's Nobel headache. So, Paul, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi there. Good to be on.
And now, you've criticized Ben Bernanke for missing the fact that there was a housing and credit bubble and for being slow to respond at the beginning of the financial crisis. But you've also written that he's earned the right to this reappointment. Why?
Because once it became clear that we had a really, really big crisis, Ben Bernanke responded aggressively, imaginatively. He understood the stakes. He may have been a little off on his forecast before it happened, but when it happened, he was as good a firefighter as we really could have hoped for. And so, you know, who would you have preferred to have in that seat this past year?
Well, tell us why. He, you know, cuts the prime lending rate, pours money into Wall Street.
It's cutting interest rates fast, realizing that we really were at risk of a second Great Depression. Unconventional policies, having the Federal Reserve out there buying commercial paper, which is, you know, private debt, having it buy long-term government debt. All of this is stuff that someone else might have hesitated, said, well, that's a little unusual. Let me wait until it's clear that we really are headed for another Great Depression. And Bernanke didn't do that, and I think we have to be thankful for that.
Well, and where do you think we are? Bernanke spoke last week with central bankers from around the world and said the prospects for a return to growth in the near term appeared good. He also warned that unemployment would remain high for another year. But was he right to be optimistic?
Well, I don't know if you call it optimistic. We're having a problem with language right now, that we basically have a binary language. We say either the economy is in recession, which is everything is going down, or the economy is in recovery, where everything's going up. We're either in hell or we're in heaven. Where we are right now, it looks like we're in purgatory. That is, the economy is probably growing if you measure it by GDP, but it's not generating jobs. The unemployment is probably going to be heading higher for quite a while. It's not the sum of all fears. 5 months ago, 6 months ago, it was actually reasonable to worry that we might be headed for 1930s conditions. That doesn't look like it's going to happen now, but it's a long, long way from what we really want to see.
Well, you know, you say purgatory. You've also said that the stimulus package wasn't bold enough. But what does someone like a Bernanke do? He's cut, as we said, the prime lending rate almost to zero, nowhere to go there, poured money into the financial markets. And you know, there's criticism that there's too much money floating out there and that he now has to navigate away from the shoals of inflation. So
That's kind of why I want someone like Bernanke, and it will turn out to be Bernanke, in there, because he understands, I think, that these pressures are always there and that the great risk now is that he will, or that the Fed and the Obama administration will start to pull back too soon. This is what happened to the U.S. economy in 1937 when Franklin Roosevelt started listening to the voices of orthodoxy. It's what happened to the Japanese in 1997 when their government started listening to the forces of orthodoxy. And you start saying, oh, well, you know, maybe we should start worrying about inflation, when actually deflation is still the pressure that's on the economy. You start saying, well, you know, we're growing even though we're very, very far below full employment, and you backslide. So, no, what he really needs to do is basically we need to keep all of these supports for the economy in place until we have a real recovery, which is not yet happening.
Well, this brings us to some of the spats you're having with people who are on the other side of the fence who say, no, too much spending. I'm thinking of Harvard historian Neil Ferguson. You both wrote a panel discussion exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, you arguing for more spending, he saying that spending is going to lead to inflation and lead other countries to question whether the U.S. continues to be a good bet with such a debt. Now, I want to put aside how heated that debate got on blogs and everything. It's going to be a new Fox series, you know, when scholars fight at the Met.
I have had two blog posts on this over the course of 4 months. You know, this is not something that's major in my life.
But it's a big – that seems to be the crux of the matter, spend or keep an eye on the debt. And what about that question? Because a headline in the Times this week reads, America may need to find another financier. Floyd Norris writing that in 2006, China and Hong Kong bought half the public U.S. Treasury. So far in 2009, they've bought only 9%. This idea that the more the U.S. goes into debt, the less like a good deal we look to other countries that are supporting us, helping to support
us. Well, there's several things you need to bear in mind here. First, the reason China is buying so much less of our debt is that we are no longer running the big trade deficits we were running in the past. We actually don't need foreign financing to anything like the same extent. Who is buying our debt is Americans, because people are looking for a safe place to put their money. And there's actually a useful role, actually a critical role played by deficits right now, because everybody's looking for a safe place to put their money. They don't want to spend it, so they're piling into U.S. government debt. If the U.S. doesn't supply that debt, the result is that there just isn't enough demand for real stuff in the economy, and the economy plunges. The reason we haven't had another Great Depression is in large part because, in fact, federal spending has continued, has been maintained at the expense of large deficits, which is not a good thing. But those deficits are, in a way, the flip side of supporting the economy through a very, very difficult time. So I don't worry at all about the revolt of the creditors. I do worry that if you look out 10 years, we will have a level of debt that is probably not crisis level, but is certainly not a good thing.
Well, and so what about that? I mean, take it off the table at the Met with economists and historians arguing, and you've debated others, including Harvard economist Greg Mankiw. What about all the people that we're seeing parading through town hall meetings? What about average Americans who are feeling frightened about just all the spending? They're not in favor of the stimulus.
Well, this is a problem because it is a little hard to explain what's going on here. I think the president hasn't done the greatest job of it. The stimulus is crucial in just putting a floor under the economy. Unfortunately, I don't think it was ever big enough to create a full recovery, but it has put a floor. If we had not had the stimulus, we would now be seeing the economy still falling as fast as it was in the first quarter of this year. We'd still be seeing the economy shrinking at a 5% annual rate. That's what pretty much all reasonable calculations suggest. And that would be – we'd be in a total panic right now. Now, the debt – we can run large deficits for several years. The U.S. is a wealthy country with a giant economy, huge tax base. What we can't do is we can't be in a country that looks like it is incapable of ever taking the hard decisions needed to balance the budget once the economy has recovered. So it's not a question about what do the numbers look like this year. The question is, are we in fact a responsible nation able to pull ourselves together in the long run?
Well, and by the way, you note in one of your recent columns that when you press people who are complaining about the stimulus and saying that they're angry about it, what they're really angry about are the bailouts, which is different the stimulus.
That's right. You say, well, why are you so against this? And they say, all this money going to bank executives. And that was a different program. It's actually a program that began under Bush. And it was almost certainly necessary to bail out some major financial institutions. Again, you don't one financial system collapse can ruin your whole day. But the way it's been done has been extremely friendly to the bankers. It has been basically rescue packages with no strings attached. It's bad economically. You could probably say, okay, we're a big country. We can afford to waste $100 billion or two. But it's terrible politically. And I think that Obama really took a wrong turn. He squandered some very badly needed populist credibility on all of this stuff.
Well, you are hugely disappointed, it would seem, from your columns with Barack Obama. You say the astonishing thing about the current political scene is that nothing has changed. And you end a column by saying, how's it going to work out? Well, a crucial opportunity is being missed. We're at a turning point and we're not making a turn.
Yeah. Now, look, the good things to say about Barack Obama is he's very smart. He's very calm. Those are things that served him very well in the final 2 months of the election campaign, when he was at least responding rationally to the financial crisis and McCain was not. But he has not been using his position to say to Americans, we really need to change from the course we've been on these past 30 years. His anti-Washington rhetoric tends to be a pox on both houses, whereas it really he really needs to turn us away from this right-wing, the market is always right, government is always bad ideology. And he has not done that because I think that's not what he believes, which is from my point of view, unfortunate.
Well, for instance, you say nationalize the banks and regulate them. You're writing it as others are. It was securitization that got us in the current mess. You know, this idea of buying and selling mortgages and banks are back doing the same thing.
Well, yeah. Now, the bank regulation white paper that came out of the Obama administration was not bad, but there doesn't seem to be any force behind it. And the bank rescues have come with no strings attached. The call that some of us had for at least being prepared to temporarily nationalize or put into receivership some of the worst banks was partly a way to make sure that taxpayers were getting a good deal. If we're going to be providing the backstopping that makes these things survive, taxpayers should have a share in the upside as well. And that did not happen. Basically, the administration has been very, very worried about disturbing the confidence of financial institutions, which it's done a great job at restoring. But unfortunately, that confidence hasn't led to lending. And in the process, they've lost the confidence of the American people, which is rather more important.
Well, and so what should he do? I mean, you quote your colleague Frank Rich, who says that there are people, especially on the left, who feel punked by Barack Obama,
yeah.
Feel as if he's not who they thought he was and is siding too much, as you said, with Wall Street and the ideology maybe of the markets.
At this point, I think the window for taking a tougher line with the banks may have passed, although we can come back to it. But we need him out there now talking about health care with real passion, real fervor, and making the moral case. Not just I'm going to bend the curve and I'm going to reduce costs, because that has turned out to open the door to people saying, oh, you're going to have death panels and shuffle the seniors off to an early grave. This needs to be in the context of this is the right thing to do. We can do this. It will be an outrage if we don't. A little bit of fire and brimstone about the opponents would be helpful. I don't know if he can do any of that. I don't know if that's him. But this is what we're missing. We're not seeing a compelling case for what can be done better. We've basically got the president portraying himself as a better manager, which undoubtedly he is compared with previous occupant of the office, but we're not seeing him really make that case for things need to be different in this country.
You write that President Obama has been weirdly unable to show passion, weirdly diffident, even about the blatant lies, as you call them, from the right. Economist Paul Krugman, when we come back, I want you to address the fears of angry seniors at town hall meetings. We're going to do that. We'll have more with economist Paul Krugman later today. Football practice in the summer sun, not a good mix. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation today with Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and columnist for The New York Times, talking about the economy. And, Paul, let's stay where we were on health care, and specifically the proposed public option for the uninsured. I want to put aside for a second what you and others say are false claims about rationing care or pulling the plug on grandma. What about concerns about cost of public option? Make your case about cost.
The costs are modest in the scheme of things. All the proposals coming from various Democratic committees are deficit neutral. That is, they all pay for the expansion.
Paul, let me just stop you there. People don't believe that. And you do point out why public options, why you believe a public option will keep costs down. How?
Public option does two things. It provides effective competition for private insurers. In most states, there really is very little competition. There is one or two insurance companies that really dominate the market. They're pretty close to being monopolies, and the public option would give them some competition. And a lot of historical experience says that a straight, simple government plan, even if it's plain vanilla, will have lower costs.
Because you point out public plans usually have lower overhead and they have more bargaining power?
That's right. We have a pretty straightforward experiment. There are these plans, Medicare Advantage, where Medicare payments are funneled through private insurance companies. For much of the history of this, it turned out that Medicare was more efficient than any of these private plans. Maybe that wouldn't be true in a larger sense, but, you know, why not have that competition and see what happens?
But what about the fear that it would be true and it would put private insurance out of business?
Well, if they can't actually provide health insurance at lower cost, then why not have the government program?
You know, one of the most interesting things I've read of yours recently, you wrote about a town hall meeting in South Carolina. It was Representative Bob Inglis. And as we've been hearing in many town halls, people were standing up, and one man in particular was saying, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare."
This is the most amazing thing. People think that health care is basically paid for privately in America. And they don't realize many of the people demonstrating the town halls are, in fact, elderly people who are on Medicare. They don't realize that we actually have a largely government-run insurance system already.
Now, we don't want to be insulting of people who absolutely understand what Medicare is, but you give other examples of town halls.
Oh, this happens all the time. Arthur Laffer of the famous or infamous Curve was on TV saying, "You just watch what happens if the government gets its hands on Medicare or Medicaid. It'll be like the post office." Of course, Medicare and Medicaid being government programs, and the post office, by the way, being highly popular among the American people. So,
even though it's
sure,
not doing well.
Yeah, but that's because it has some mandates. Anyway, the point is there's been a tremendous amount of misinformation spread, and I don't think people are stupid. I think people are busy. They're harassed. They have lives. And if you have a constant flood of disinformation coming from the right, pretty much not fact-checked by many news media organizations, then people get a distorted impression. Can I say this is important because this actually relates to the issue of cost. When we ask the question, can we afford to have universal health insurance? The expensive people, the elderly, the very sick, are already covered by the taxpayer. They're covered by Medicare. They're covered by Medicaid. Private insurance companies only pay for about a third of health care in America right now. And the people who are uninsured tend to be young adults. They're actually cheap. It really costs remarkably little extra money to pay for the health care of the people who are now out in the cold.
But back to the huge fear, we were talking about the elderly and the Medicare recipients. And as you were saying, I mean, you give other examples of town hall meetings where people are screaming, keep the government out of my health care, and then they're asked to raise hands who's on Medicare, and the whole room raises their hands. There's this disconnect somehow of not understanding that government is already in their health care. But there's a fear that Medicare in particular is going to be cut to pay for this new plan.
It's certainly not in the plan. What's in the plan is simply that Medicare should do research into which treatments are effective and that this should be used to provide recommendations about what it pays for. The credible irony here is that the Republicans who are pushing this are the people who have been screaming for decades either that we must not have Medicare before it was implemented or that we must cut it. I mean, do people remember the government shutdown of 1995? The U.S. government shut down for a while and shut down in a confrontation between the Republican Congress and President Bill Clinton. And it happened because the Republicans were trying to force Clinton to agree to savage cuts in Medicare funding. Now those same people are saying, oh, the Democrats are going to take away your Medicare. They're going to send you to the death panels. It's incredible that this is happening right now.
Well, and that's the language that has very much frightened people. They think that an 85-year-old or an 80-year-old is going to be judged, you know, the treatment is going to be judged unnecessarily just because of your age.
It does not mean that at all. What researchers have looked at, what's very much influencing all of this, is that Medicare has vastly uneven spending across the United States. You can look at a place like Minneapolis and find that it spends much, much less on Medicare recipients than Miami does, or actually New York does. What's happening is that in some places, basically the medical system has gone wild. Doctors ordering lots of unnecessary tests, doctors performing procedures that are as likely to do harm or more likely to do harm than good. Mm-hmm. So all that we're talking about here is trying to provide some guidance so that we don't waste money and actually probably degrade the quality of seniors' lives with unnecessary procedures.
And what about people on the other side of the fence who say, yes, we need improved health care, but pay for it with tax credits. Let the market do it. Don't completely revamp what we have, which some people feel is pretty good.
That's fine as long as you've never had a hangnail. Basically, the trouble with trying to do this through the individual market is that we know that it works terribly because insurance companies will reject you for insurance if you have any sort of pre-existing condition or anything they might interpret. So this notion that the market is the solution is a faith that flies totally in the face of evidence. This is a pure fantasy driven by ideology.
That's Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Paul, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Okay, we want to give you a chance to air your thoughts. Just go to hearandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us to send an email. You can scroll down and click on Comments, leave one right there, or make a phone call. Just get it off your chest. We'd love to hear from you. And tomorrow on Here and Now, there are rules and regulations for banks, not as many as Paul Krugman would like, but maybe some new ones mean it's time to get a new credit card. That's the story tomorrow. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Scotland's decision to release the Libyan convicted in the 1988 Lockerbie bombing is now raising questions about Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's visit to the U.S. next month. Gaddafi plans to set up his luxury tent on the lawn of a Libyan-owned estate in Englewood, New Jersey. New Jersey lost 33 people in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and residents and public officials there are outraged. And there are also questions about whether President Obama will face an awkward meeting with Gaddafi when Gaddafi comes to the UN in September. The Scottish Justice Minister said he released Abdelbaset al-Megrahi because he's dying of prostate cancer. But when al-Megrahi received a hero's welcome in Libya, it set off a firestorm from people who believe Scotland and Greater Britain's real motivation might have been Libya's oil. BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus joins us from London. Jonathan, what's been the reaction there?
Well, I think just as in the United States, there has been a lot of criticism of the decision. I think, though, there was a particular problem for the Scottish government here because there is no federal system like in the United States. There is no United Kingdom-wide Supreme Court that might make these decisions. So what the Scottish government found itself in, and the Scottish Justice Minister, that he found himself making a decision on a very narrow basis to look at what Scottish law had done in the past with similar cases where people convicted of very serious crimes had been very close to death themselves. There was a great difference of opinion in Scotland too, but he was backed, and he has been backed, for example, by the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland, by the main Protestant churches in Scotland, and the broader foreign policy implications of all of this were really not something that it was the Scottish government's position to consider.
Well, but as you well know, this isn't any criminal, just any criminal, and there is the thinking that this was part of a trade deal between Britain and Libya. Gaddafi's son was involved in talks. So what do we know more about that?
There is no doubt there have been a lot of contacts with Libya, not just by Britain, but by the United States, in the wake of Libya coming in from the cold, renouncing terrorism, giving up its weapons of mass destruction programs, and so on. And there is equally no doubt that part and parcel of that is a desire both to engage with Libya in counter-terrorism activities, but also, of course, to be able to exploit Libyan oil and gas reserves. Now, that is the decision that has been made, that it is better to have Libya, if you like, inside the tent rather than outside. I think think there has been no substantial evidence shown that this specific decision was in any way influenced by specific trading concerns. Yes, there have been meetings with Lord Mandelson, senior British government minister, and one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons. Yes, of course, the Libyans have said that every time they have discussed trade deals with Britain and with the West, Mr. al-Megrahi's case has been brought up. But I think it would be very hard at the moment to find any really conclusive evidence of a specific link between any specific trade deals and the decision by the Scottish Justice Minister to release Mr. al-Megrahi on compassionate grounds.
Jonathan Marcus, what happens now, though? You mentioned Gaddafi being the leader who came in from the cold. He's supposedly the rehabilitated leader, and here he is on the way to the UN next month. What happens then? What can world leaders like President Obama and maybe British Prime Minister Gordon Brown do from here on out if they are seen shaking his hand? What happens?
Well, I think clearly there are going to have to be some very serious thinking given to how they interact, if at all, with the Libyan leader. Earlier today, Gordon Brown, in really his first significant comment on the whole affair, made it clear that he was angered and repulsed at the reception that Mr. al-Megrahi had had in Libya. One should note this was a reception that went entirely against the expressed wishes of Gordon Brown. He told the Libyan leader very clearly that he was expecting a rather more low-key approach when Mr. al-Megrahi returned to Libyan soil. So I think it's going to be interesting now to see how key Western leaders, with the UN General Assembly coming up, choose to deal with the Libyan leader.
And keep him in from the cold. That's Jonathan Marcus, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, speaking to us from London. Jonathan, many thanks.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Okay, just ahead today, a new program to treat adults with autism as adults. Most of them are still seeing their pediatricians. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. In the 1980s, there was a surge in the number of children diagnosed with autism. Today, on average, one in 150 children born are eventually diagnosed with a neurological disorder. Why so many? Well, that's still a matter of great debate. But one thing we do know, those early patients are grown up now, and by and large, the medical community still treats them like children. Through the generosity of a $29 million gift and the advocacy of our next guest, Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital is launching a new program that will focus on adult autism. It's called the Lurie Family Autism Center. Dr. Margaret Bauman is an associate professor of neurology at Harvard and the director of Ladders at Mass General Hospital. That's a program she founded back in 1981 for learning and developmental disabilities. So, doctor, first of all, tell us, how many adult autism patients are we talking about, and what kind of special treatment do they need as they get older?
Well, in the first place, I think that number is really not known. All I can say is that we've been in business long enough that as many of our children have grown up and now are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, it's very hard to identify the adults because many of them change over time and they look, I don't want to say they look less autistic, but many of them kind of drift into the world of mental retardation and other developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. So how many adults really are out there with autism, I don't really know what that figure is. In terms of what kinds of services these folks require, they certainly require regular medical care. The problem is that it's much harder for such a person to access these services. Frequently, they're seen in clinics such as the neurology clinic or the medicine clinic at a hospital like the Mass General Hospital, and that's a fine place to be, and they're generally seen by the house officers, the fellows, the residents, and such. The downside of that is that many of those people rotate out, so the continuity of care is not really mm-hmm. there long term. The other thing that I think is a little bit difficult is that many of them don't have means of necessarily pointing to their head or pointing to their stomach and telling you that they have a stomach ache. And we've discovered, just because we've had this clinic that's been a multidisciplinary clinic and we've been able to include a gastroenterologist, for example, and a psychopharmacologist and all these other ancillary services, it's really kind of a one-stop shop operation where families can get a much more comprehensive overview of their relatives relatives regular clinical care. Then there's the issue of how do you get them into the vocational area? Some of our kids are now going on to college. How do you manage that? So it's really getting much more complex, frankly, given the fact that many of them had very good services when they were little now. And coming up through the ranks, the college-bound kids are going to be a challenge for not only those of us from a medical point of view, but for the colleges and universities as well.
Is there anything to the thought, too, that an autism center for adults, or primarily for adults with autism, I don't know, might treat them differently? Is there a sense that they will be treated less like children, and that may be a good thing if they're...
I certainly hope so. I think the general public's expectations for anybody on the autism spectrum probably isn't as high as it should be. And there are some wonderful adults who are nonverbal who are extremely bright and who are communicating with us now through these voice output systems and various technologies that have come online. And we've discovered that there's a lot in those heads that they're not able to express. And I think, you know, it's probably been pretty insulting, frankly, for a lot of these adults to be treated like children because that's the way they've been perceived.
And what about the fact that, you know, they are growing older, as you said? You mentioned perhaps job training and things to make them more functioning in society. And listeners might remember author Carl Taro Greenfeld's recent book about having to take care of his sibling Noah. And being very frank about resenting it, he writes, "Will I always be there for Noah as my parents have been? I wish I could say yes, but honestly, I don't know." Is that part of what the center might be there for, to help when siblings just can't do what their parents did?
Sure. Absolutely. I think our goal is first of all, to start very early to help these people become as independent as they possibly can be, to help them develop job skills. Many of our families are now establishing farm communities or other kinds of communities where their growing child will live someday and be supported in a small community residence. And I have one young man who's 30 years old who loves to vacuum, has always loved to vacuum when he was younger, found a wonderful job in a well-respected hotel, and he's been the employee of the month twice and has really been quite successful at doing that. And he takes the bus back and forth to his home, but he is a pretty independent guy.
Dr. Bellman, you, as we said, are in the forefront of autism research. You were part of debunking the myth that the cause of autism was the refrigerator moms, I think is the phrase.
That's right.
You know, a cold mom.
Yep.
Not true.
Not true.
But why do you think we've had this increase in cases?
I think there are a couple of factors. One is, back then when I was a resident, the refrigerator mother story was still there. And so our ability to give that diagnosis to a child, even if we thought they had autism, was difficult because that implied that the parent was a bad parent. And there were virtually no services. Many of these people were put into institutions, and it was really difficult to give a diagnosis to somebody at that point. After the 80s, when it became clearer that this was a developmental disability that began before birth, I think we've now broadened the spectrum. When I was a resident, a person who was an autistic person sat in a corner, rocked back and forth, had no eye contact, and had no language. I mean, the last time I've seen a child like that, I can't remember. Now, you could say, well, you know, has the whole presentation changed somehow? And maybe those kids really have, in fact, gotten less instead of more. Or is it that we're picking them up early, which is what we like to believe, and giving them early intervention services so we really don't see that kind of syndrome anymore? We've, as I've said, broadened the definition. When I was a resident, we didn't have a thing called Asperger syndrome. We didn't have the term pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. That didn't exist. Now, is there also something else in the environment? I think most of us in science believe that this is a very genetically loaded disorder, but the remaining question is this a genetic vulnerability for something in the environment? And I don't know the answer to that.
Do you know that it's not vaccines?
Yes, I'm fairly confident it's not vaccines.
Yeah.
This is a disorder that begins prenatally. That's what the anatomy tells us, and there's absolutely no evidence from a neurobiological perspective that it's either vaccines or mercury.
Just fascinating. That's Dr. Margaret Bauman. She's a child neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston, also the MGH Distinguished Scholar in Autism. And the hospital's Lurie Family Autism Center officially opens today. Dr. Bauman, thank you and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, before we go today, are you heading out for football practice, or maybe your child is? Well, it's been in the 80s, 90s, 100s across the country. Is this a good idea? That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to the Sports Corner of Here and Now. We have some quick news to start. World champion runner Caster Semenya was greeted by thousands of fans today in Johannesburg, South Africa, returning from Berlin, where last week she won the Women's World 800 Meters title. But the teenager's victory has been overshadowed by questions about whether she is a she or a he. The BBC is reporting today that tests reveal her testosterone level is 3 times higher than those expected in a female sample. The International Association of Athletic Federations had demanded that she take a gender identification test, but final results won't be known for a while. Some more sports news. Next week, a criminal trial is scheduled to begin in Kentucky in connection with the heat-related death of a high school football player on the Pleasure Ridge Park High School team. Former coach Jason Stinson is charged with reckless homicide after 15-year-old Max Gilpin collapsed during football practice in August of 2008 and died 3 days later in a Louisville hospital. Stinson, who's been reassigned from his coaching duties pending the result of his criminal trial, pled not guilty. 2008 was one of the deadliest years on record for heat-related football deaths. Besides Max Gilpin, 5 other players died from heat stroke. And so far this preseason, at least 3 high school or college players have died. Whether it's the heat is still being determined. But we wanted to check in on summer football practice. Doug Tribou from NPR's Only a Game prepared this report.
For many fans, football is a rite of fall that goes hand in hand with the new school year and the changing colors of the foliage. But for players and coaches, the real work begins with training camps and double session practices in sometimes sweltering summer weather. During the 2008 football season, 4 high school and 2 college players died of heat stroke. That's the highest number of heat stroke deaths since 7 players died in 1972. Frederick Mueller is the director of the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research, which is based at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The American Football Coaches Association tracks football-related deaths. Mueller co-authors that annual survey.
Since 1995, there's been the increase in the number of heat stroke deaths. There have been 39 total through 2008. 29 of those are at the high school level, and since 95, it's been a real concern.
There have been 125 heat stroke deaths since the data was first recorded in 1931. Perhaps the most widely reported of them happened on July 31, 2001, when Vikings offensive lineman Corey Stringer collapsed during the second day of training camp in Mankato, Minnesota. The heat index, which combines temperature and humidity, reached 110 on the field that day. The 335-pound tackle was coming off his first All-Pro season. He died the next day. The 27-year-old is the only player in NFL history to die of heat stroke. Jimmy Gould was Stringer's agent and now serves as spokesman for the Stringer family. Gould says players need to be educated about the risks so they'll be more comfortable admitting when they're not feeling well.
No one's going to challenge what a coach or a trainer or anybody is going to tell them. I mean, they're there to take the orders and go and deliver the blows and do what they got to do. That's the sport.
In 2003, Stringer's widow settled with one of the doctors who treated her husband. Earlier this year, Kelsey Stringer and the NFL also agreed to a settlement, which includes plans for a league-sponsored program to educate amateur and professional coaches and players about the dangers of heat illness. Kelsey Stringer is also suing Riddell, the maker of the helmet and shoulder pads Corey Stringer wore at training camp. The lawsuit alleges Riddell had an obligation to put warnings about heat stroke on the equipment. Riddell turned down Only a Game's requests for an interview. Via email, a spokesman wrote, quote, As we intend to aggressively defend our products at trial, it would be inappropriate to comment on the facts and issues involved prior to trial, unquote. Stringer family spokesman Jimmy Gould says he believes warnings could have made a difference.
It forces the trainers and the people that are there on site to pay special attention that there is a reason if there's a warning in it. Whereas if there's no warning in it, they just put it on because that's just behavior. By having the warning, you're telling somebody this may have been the way it was back when, but there's just too many people going down right now.
As Riddell and the Stringers prepare for a jury trial in U.S. District Court in November, a criminal trial involving another football death is set to begin on August 31st in Kentucky. 15-year-old Max Gilpin collapsed during practice in Louisville last August and died 3 days later. According to the Jefferson County Coroner's Office, the sophomore's body temperature was 107 degrees. His coach, David Jason Stinson, is charged with reckless homicide and may also face a charge of first-degree wanton endangerment. The maximum sentence for each is 5 years in prison. Gilpin's parents have also filed a civil suit against Stinson and other school employees. Frederick Mueller says in nearly three decades of tracking football deaths, this is the first time he's heard of a coach facing criminal charges after a heatstroke incident. Mueller's 2009 report is unequivocal about football's heat-related deaths. Quote, "There is no excuse for any number of heatstroke deaths since they are all preventable with the proper precautions," unquote. Mueller says there are several steps teams need to take to protect players.
You don't know where they're coming from if they haven't been working out all summer. They may have been in the mountains in a cooler climate. You have to acclimatize the athletes to get them used to the heat. Weigh in before practice, weigh out after practice, see how much weight you've lost. Rest periods for the athletes, let them take off their helmets, cool down, let them drink cold water.
Dr. Alan Asher is the chairman of the Student Health and Sports Medicine Committee for the Massachusetts Medical Society. Asher says improper hydration is a major safety issue, and educational programs for players and coaches need to break down the perception that withholding water will make players tougher.
Some coaches feel that if you take a drink during the practice, that indicates you're less capable, and indeed that's just not true. The better you hydrate, I think the better you're going to play.
At least three players have died in preseason practices in 2009. On July 8th, Western Carolina University player Jaquavin Smalls died during voluntary workouts in North Carolina. On July 29th, Fort Campbell Jr. Timothy Williams became the third Kentucky high school football player to die in the past 4 years after he became disoriented at practice. And last week, 16-year-old Raymond Tyndall was practicing for New Madrid County Central High School in Missouri when he collapsed and died. The final autopsy results are pending for all three athletes.
PRI, Public Radio International.